cut as deeply into his larynx. A single sphere of dark blood had congealed there, like some strange precious stone, a red-black pearl. Case saw the crude wooden handles that drifted at either end of the garrote, like worn sections of broom handle.
"Wonder how long he had that on him,"
Case said, remembering Corto's post-war pilgrimage.
"He know how pilot boat, Case, boss man?"
"Maybe. He was special forces."
"Well, this Japan boy, he not be pilotin'. Doubt I pilot her easy myself. Ver new boat."
"So find us the bridge."
Malcolm frowned, rolled backward, and kicked. Case followed him into a larger space, a kind of lounge, shredding and crumpling the lengths of printout that snared him in his passage. There were more of the articulated chairs here, something that resembled a bar, and the hosaka. The printer, still spewing its flimsy tongue of paper, was an inbuilt bulkhead unit, a neat slot in a panel of hand-rubbed veneer. He pulled himself over the circle of chairs and reached it, punching a white stud to the left of the slot. The chattering stopped. He turned and stared at the hosaka. Its face had been drilled through at least a dozen times. The holes were small, circular, edges blackened. Tiny spheres of bright alloy were orbiting the dead computer.
"Good guess,"
he said to Malcolm.
"Bridge locked, mon,"
Malcolm said, from the opposite side of the lounge. The lights dimmed, surged, dimmed again. Case ripped the printout from its slot. More zeros.
"Wintermute?"
He looked around the beige and brown lounge, the space scrawled with drifting curves of paper.
"That you on the lights, Wintermute?"
A panel beside Malcolm's head slid up, revealing a small monitor. Malcolm jerked apprehensively, wiped sweat from his forehead with a foam patch on the back of a gloved hand, and swung to study the display.
"You read Japanese, man?"
Case could see figures blinking past on the screen.
"No,"
Case said.
"Bridge is escape pod. Lifeboat. Counting down, looks like it. Suit up now."
He ringed his helmet and slapped at the seals.
"What? He's taken off? Shit!"
He kicked off from the bulkhead and shot through the tangle of printout.
"We gotta open this door, man!"
But Malcolm could only tap the side of his helmet. Case could see his lips moving through the Lexan. He saw a bead of sweat arc out from the rainbow-braided band of the purple cotton net the Zionite wore over his locks. Malcolm snatched the helmet from Case and ringed it for him smoothly, the palms of his gloves smacking the seals. Micro-LED monitors to the left of the faceplate lit as the neck ring connections closed.
"No say Japanese,"
Malcolm said, over his suit's transceiver.
"But countdown's wrong."
He tapped a particular line on the screen.
"Seals not intact. Bridge module. Launching with lock open."
"Armitage!"
Case tried to pound on the door. The physics of zero-G sent him tumbling back through the printout.
"Corto, don't do it! We gotta talk! We gotta—"
"Case? Read you, Case."
The voice barely resembled Armitage's now. It held a weird calm. Case stopped kicking. His helmet struck the far wall.
"I'm sorry, Case, but it has to be this way. One of us has to get out. One of us has to testify. If we all go down here, it ends here. I'll tell them, Case. I'll tell them all of it. About Girling and the others. And I'll make it, Case. I know I'll make it. To Helsinki."
There was a sudden silence. Case felt it fill his helmet like some rare gas.
"But it's so hard, Case. So goddamn hard. I'm blind."
"Corto, stop, wait. You're blind, man. You can't fly. You'll hit the fucking trees. And they're trying to get you, Corto, I swear to God. They've left your hatch open. You'll die. And you'll never get to tell him. And I gotta get the enzyme. Name of the enzyme! The enzyme, man!
He was shouting, voice high with hysteria. Feedback shrilled out of the helmet's phone pads. Remember the training case. That's all we can do. And then the helmet filled with a confused babble, roaring static, harmonics howling down the ears from screaming fist, fragments of Russian, and then a stranger's voice, Midwestern, very young.
We are down. Repeat. Omaha Thunder is down. We...
Wintermute! Case screamed. Don't do this to me!
Tears broke from his lashes, rebounding off the faceplate in wobbling crystal droplets. Then Haniwa thudded, once, shivered, as if some huge soft thing had struck her hull. Case imagined the lifeboat jolting free, blown clear by explosive bolts, a second's clawing hurricane of escaping air tearing mad Colonel Corto from his couch, from Wintermute's rendition of the final minute of Screaming Fist.
Him gone, man.
Malcolm looked at the monitor.
Hatch open. Mute must override ejection failsafe.
Case tried to wipe the tears of rage from his eyes. His fingers clacked against Lexan.
Yacht, she tight for air. But boss man taken grapple control with bridge. Marcus Garvey still stuck.
But Case was seeing Armitage's endless fall around Freeside, through vacuum colder than the steps. For some reason, he imagined him in his dark Burberry, the trench coat's rich folds spread out around him, like the wings of some huge bat. Chapter 17.
Get what you went for?
The construct asked. Quang grade Mark 11 was filling the grid between itself and the TA ice with hypnotically intricate traceries of rainbow, lattices fine as snow crystal on a winter window.
Wintermute killed Armitage. Blew him out in a lifeboat with a hatch open.
Tough shit, the flatline said. Weren't exactly asshole buddies, were you?
He knew how to unbond the toxin sacks.
So Wintermute knows, too. Count on it.
I don't exactly trust Wintermute to give it to me.
The construct's hideous approximation of laughter scraped Case's nerves like a dull blade.
Maybe that means you're getting smart.
He hit the SimStim switch. 06-2752 by the chip in her optic nerve. Case had been following her progress through Villa Straylight for over an hour, letting the endorphin analog she'd taken blot out his hangover. The pain in her leg was gone. She seemed to move through a warm bath. The brawn drone was perched on her shoulder, its tiny manipulators like padded surgical clips, secure in the polycarbon of the modern suit. The walls here were raw steel, striped with rough brown ribbons of epoxy where some kind of covering had been ripped away. She'd hidden from a work crew, crouching, the Fletcher cradled in her hands, her suit steel gray, while the two slender Africans and their balloon-tired work cart passed. The men had shaven heads and wore orange coveralls. One was singing softly to himself in a language Case had never heard, the tones and melody alien and haunting. The head's speech, Three Jane's essay on Straylight, came back to him as she worked her way deeper into the maze of the place. Straylight was crazy, was craziness grown in the resin concrete they'd mixed from pulverized lunar stone, grown in welded steel and tons of knickknacks, all the bizarre impedimenta they'd shipped up the well to line their winding nest. But it wasn't a craziness he understood. Not like Armitage's madness, which he now imagined he could understand. Twist a man far enough, then twist him as far back in the opposite direction, reverse and twist again. The man broke, like breaking a length of wire, and history had done that for Colonel Corto. History had already done the really messy work when Wintermute found him, sifting him out of all the war's ripe detritus, gliding into the man's flat gray field of consciousness like a water spider crossing the face of some stagnant pool, the first messages blinking across the face of a child's micro in a darkened room in a French asylum. Wintermute had built Armitage up from scratch, with Corto's memories of Screaming Fist as the foundation. But Armitage's memories wouldn't have been Corto's after a certain point. Case doubted if Armitage had recalled the betrayal, the Nightwings whirling down in flame. Armitage had been a sort of edited version of Corto, and when the stress of the run had reached a certain point, the Armitage mechanism had crumbled. Corto had surfaced, with his guilt and his sick fury. And now Corto Armitage was dead, a small frozen moon for Freeside. He thought of the toxin sacks. Old Ashpool was dead too, drilled through the eye with Molly's microscopic dart, deprived of whatever expert overdose he'd mixed for himself. That was a more puzzling death, Ashpool's, the death of a mad king. And he'd killed the puppet he'd called his daughter, the one with Three Jane's face. It seemed to Case, as he rode Molly's broadcast sensory input through the corridors of Straylight, that he'd never really thought of anyone like Ashpool, anyone as powerful as he imagined Ashpool had been, as human. Power, in Case's world, meant corporate power. The Zaibatsus, the multinationals that shaped the course of human history, had transcended old barriers. Viewed as organisms, they had attained a kind of immortality. You couldn't kill a Zaibatsu by assassinating a dozen key executives. There were others waiting to step up the ladder, assume the vacated position, access the vast banks of corporate memory. But Tessier Ashpool wasn't like that, and he sensed the difference in the death of its founder. T.A. was an atavism, a clan. He remembered the litter of the old man's chamber, the soiled humanity of it, the ragged spines of the old audio discs in their paper sleeves, one foot bare, the other in a velvet slipper. The brawn plucked at the hood of the modern suit, and Molly turned left, through another archway. Wintermute and the Nest. Phobic vision of the hatching wasps, time-lapse machine gun of biology. But weren't the Zaibatsus more like that, or the Yakuza, hives with cybernetic memories, vast single organisms, their DNA coded in silicon? If Straylight was an expression of the corporate identity of Tessier Ashpool, then T.A. was crazy as the old man had been. The same ragged tangle of fears, the same strange sense of aimlessness. If they'd turned into what they wanted to, he remembered Molly saying. But Wintermute had told her they hadn't. Case had always taken it for granted that the real bosses, the kingpins in a given industry, would be both more and less than people. He'd seen it in the men who'd crippled him in Memphis. He'd seen Wage affect the semblance of it in Night City, and it had allowed him to accept Armitage's flatness and lack of feeling. He'd always imagined it as a gradual and willing accommodation of the machine, the system, the parent organism. It was the root of street cool, too, the knowing posture that implied connection, invisible lines up to hidden levels of influence. But what was happening now in the corridors of Villa Straylight? Whole stretches were being stripped back to steel and concrete. "Wonder where our Peter is now, huh? Maybe see that boy soon," she muttered. "And Armitage, where's he, Case?" "Dead," he said, knowing she couldn't hear him. "He's dead." He flipped. The Chinese program was face-to-face with the target ice, rainbow tints gradually dominated by the green of the rectangle representing the TA cores, arches of emerald across the colorless void.
"How's it go, Dixie?"
"Fine. Too slick. Things amazing. Should have had one that time in Singapore. Did the old New Bank of Asia for a good 50th of what they were worth. But that's ancient history. This baby takes all the drudgery out of it. Makes you wonder what a real war would be like now."
"If this kind of shit was on the street, we'd be out of job," Case said.
"You wish. Wait till you're steering that thing upstairs through black ice."
"Sure."
Something small and decidedly non-geometric had just appeared on the far end of one of the emerald arches.
Dixie?
Yeah, I see it. Don't know if I believe it.
A brownish dot, a dull gnat against the green wall of the TA cores. It began to advance across the bridge built by Quang Grade Mark 11, and Case saw that it was walking. As it came, the green section of the arch extended, the polychrome of the virus program rolling back a few steps ahead of the cracked black shoes.
"Gotta hand it to you, boss,"
the flatline said, when the short, rumpled figure of the Finn seemed to stand a few meters away.
"I never seen anything this funny when I was alive."
But the eerie non-laugh didn't come.
"I never tried it before,"
the Finn said, showing his teeth, his hands bunched in the pockets of his frayed jacket.
"You killed Armitage,"
Case said.
"Corto, yeah. Armitage was already gone. Had to do it. I know, you want to get the enzyme. Okay, no sweat. I was the one gave it to Armitage in the first place. I mean, I told him what to use. But I think maybe it's better to let the deal stand. You got enough time. I'll give it to you. Only a couple of hours now, right?"
Case watched blue smoke billow in cyberspace as the Finn lit up one of his Partagas.
"You guys," the Finn said, "you're a pain. The flatline here, if you were all like him, it'd be real simple. He's a construct, just a bunch of ROM, so he always does what I expect him to. My projection said there wasn't much chance of Molly wandering in on Ashpool's big exit scene, give you one example."
He sighed.
"Why'd he kill himself?"
Case asked.
"Why's anybody kill himself?"
The figure shrugged.
"I guess I know if anybody does, but it would take me 12 hours to explain the various factors in his history and how they interrelate. He was ready to do it for a long time, but he kept going back into the freezer. Christ, he was a tedious old fuck."
The Finn's face wrinkled with disgust.
"It's all tied in with why he killed his wife, mainly. You want the short reason. But what sent him over the edge for good and all, little 3-Jane figured a way to fiddle the program that controlled his cryogenic system. Subtle, too. So basically she killed him. Except he figured he'd killed himself, and your friend the Avenging Angel figures she got him with an eyeball full of shellfish juice."
The Finn flicked his butt away into the matrix below.
"Well, actually, I guess I did give 3-Jane the odd hint. A little of the old how-to, you know?"
"Wintermute," Case said, choosing the words carefully. "You told me you were just a part of something else. Later on you said you wouldn't exist if the run goes off and Molly gets the word into the right slot." The Finn's streamlined skull nodded.
"Okay, then who are we going to be dealing with then? If Armitage is dead and you're going to be gone, just who exactly is going to tell me how to get these fucking toxin sacks out of my system? Who's going to get Molly back out of there? I mean, where exactly are all our asses going to be? We cut you loose from the hardwiring."
The Finn took a wooden toothpick from his pocket and regarded it critically, like a surgeon examining a scalpel.
"Good question," he said finally. "You know, salmon, kind of fish? These fish, see, they're compelled to swim upstream. Got it?"
"No,"
Case said.
"Well, I'm under compulsion myself, and I don't know why. If I were going to subject you to my very own thoughts, let's call them speculations on the topic, it would take a couple of your lifetimes, because I've given it a lot of thought. And I just don't know. But when this is over, we do it right, I'm going to be part of something bigger. Much bigger."
The Finn glanced up and around the matrix.
"But the parts of me that are me now, that'll still be here, and you'll get your payoff."
Case fought back an insane urge to punch himself forward and get his fingers around the figure's throat, just above the ragged knot in the rusty scarf, his thumbs deep in the Finn's larynx.
"Well, good luck," the Finn said.
He turned, hands in pockets, and began trudging back up the green arch.
"Hey, asshole,"
the flatline said when the Finn had gone a dozen paces. The figure paused, half-turned.
"What about me? What about my payoff?"
"You'll get yours," it said.
"What's that mean?"
Case asked, as he watched the narrow tweed back recede.
"I want to be erased," the construct said. "I told you that, remember?"
Straylight reminded Case of deserted early morning shopping centers he'd known as a teenager, low-density places where the small hours brought a fitful stillness, a kind of numb expectancy, a tension that left you watching insects swarm around caged bulbs above the entrance of darkened shops. Fringe places, just past the borders of the sprawl, too far from the all-night click and shudder of the hot core. There was that same sense of being surrounded by the sleeping inhabitants of a waking world he had no interest in visiting or knowing, of dull business temporarily suspended, of futility and repetition soon to wake again. Molly had slowed now, either knowing that she was nearing her goal or out of concern for her leg. The pain was starting to work its jagged way back through the endorphins, and he wasn't sure what that meant. She didn't speak, kept her teeth clenched, and carefully regulated her breathing. She'd passed many things that Case hadn't understood, but his curiosity was gone. There had been a room filled with shelves of books, a million flat leaves of yellowing paper pressed between bindings of cloth or leather, the shelves marked at intervals by labels that followed a code of letters and numbers, a crowded gallery where Case had stared, through Molly's incurious eyes, at a shattered, dust-stenciled sheet of glass, a thing labeled. Her gaze had tracked the brass plaque automatically. "La marée misée à nous par ses célibataires même." She'd reached out and touched this, her artificial nails clicking against the Lexan sandwich protecting the broken glass. There had been what was obviously the entrance to Tessier Ashpool's cryogenic compound, circular doors of black glass trimmed with chrome. She'd seen no one since the two Africans in their cart, and for Case, they'd taken on a sort of imaginary life. He pictured them gliding gently through the halls of Straylight, their smooth, dark skulls gleaming, nodding, while the one still sang his tired little song. And none of this was anything like the Villa Straylight he would have expected, some cross between Kath's fairy tale castle and a half-remembered childhood fantasy of the Yakuza's inner sanctum. 07:02:18. 1.5 hours.
"Case," she said, "I want a favor."
Stiffly, she lowered herself to sit on a stack of polished steel plates, the finish of each plate protected by an uneven coating of clear plastic. She picked at a rip in the plastic on the topmost plate, blade sliding from beneath thumb and forefinger.
"Leg's not good, you know? Didn't figure any climb like that, and the endorphin won't cut it much longer. So maybe, just maybe, right? I got a problem here. What it is, if I buy it here, before Riviera does..."
And she stretched her leg, kneaded the flesh of her thigh through modern polycarbon and Paris leather.
"I want you to tell him it was me. Got it? Just say, it was Molly. He'll know. Okay?"
She glanced around the empty hallway, the bare walls. The floor here was raw lunar concrete, and the air smelled of resins.
"Shit, man. I don't even know if you're listening."
"Case." She winced, got to her feet, nodded.
"What's he told you, man? Wintermute. He tell you about Marie France? She was the Tessier half, Three Jane's genetic mother. And of that dead puppet of Ashpool's, I guess.
Can't figure why he'd tell me, down in that cubicle. Lot of stuff. Why he has to come on like the Finn or somebody. He told me that. It's not just a mask. It's like he uses real profiles as valves, gears himself down to communicate with us. Called it a template, model of personality.
She drew her Fletcher and limped away down the corridor. The bare steel and scabrous epoxy ended abruptly, replaced by what Case at first took to be a rough tunnel blasted from solid rock. Molly examined its edge, and he saw that in fact the steel was sheathed with panels of something that looked and felt like cold stone. She knelt and touched the dark sand spread across the floor of the imitation tunnel. It felt like sand, cool and dry, but when she drew her finger through it, it closed like a fluid, leaving the surface undisturbed. A dozen meters ahead, the tunnel curved. Harsh yellow light threw hard shadows on the seamed pseudo-rock of the walls. With a start, Case realized that the gravity here was near Earth normal, which meant that she'd had to descend again after the climb. He was thoroughly lost now. Spatial disorientation held a peculiar horror for cowboys. But she wasn't lost, he told himself. Something scurried between her legs and went ticking across the unsand of the floor. A red LED blinked. The Brawn. The first of the holos waited just beyond the curve, a sort of triptych. She lowered the Fletcher before Case had had time to realize that the thing was a recording. The figures were caricatures in light, life-size cartoons. Molly, Armitage, and Case. Molly's breasts were too large, visible through tight black mesh beneath a heavy leather jacket. Her waist was impossibly narrow. Silvered lenses covered half her face. She held an absurdly elaborate weapon of some kind, a pistol shape nearly lost beneath a flanged overlay of scope sights, silencers, flash hiders. Her legs were spread, pelvis canted forward, her mouth fixed in a leer of idiotic cruelty. Beside her, Armitage stood rigidly at attention in a threadbare khaki uniform. His eyes, Case saw, as Molly stepped carefully forward, were tiny monitor screens, each one displaying the blue-gray image of a howling waste of snow, the stripped black trunks of evergreens bending in silent winds. She passed the tips of her fingers through Armitage's television eyes, then turned to the figure of Case. Here, it was as if Riviera, and Case had known instantly that Riviera was responsible, had been unable to find anything worthy of parody. The figure that slouched there was a fair approximation of the one he glimpsed daily in mirrors. Thin, high-shouldered, a forgettable face beneath short dark hair. He needed a shave, but then he usually did. Molly stepped back. She looked from one figure to another. It was a static display, the only movement the silent gusting of the black trees in Armitage's frozen Siberian eyes.
"Trying to tell us something, Peter?" she asked softly.
Then she stepped forward and kicked at something between the feet of the holo Molly. Metal clinked against the wall, and the figures were gone. She bent and picked up a small display unit.
"Guess he can jack into these and program them direct," she said, tossing it away.
She passed the source of yellow light, an archaic incandescent globe set into the wall, protected by a rusty curve of expansion grating. The style of the improvised fixture suggested childhood somehow. He remembered fortresses he'd built with other children, on rooftops and in flooded sub-basements. A rich kid's hideout, he thought. This kind of roughness was expensive, what they called atmosphere. She passed a dozen more holograms before she reached the entrance to Three Jane's apartments. One depicted the eyeless thing in the alley behind the spice bazaar, as it tore itself free of Riviera's shattered body. Several others were scenes of torture, the inquisitors always military officers, and the victims invariably young women.
these had the awful intensity of Riviera's show at the 20th siècle, as though they had been frozen in the blue flash of orgasm. Molly looked away as she passed them. The last was small and dim, as if it were an image Riviera had had to drag across some private distance of memory and time. She had to kneel to examine it. It had been projected from the vantage point of a small child. None of the others had had backgrounds. The figures, uniforms, instruments of torture had all been freestanding displays, but this was a view. A dark wave of rubble rose against a colorless sky. Beyond its crest, the bleached, half-melted skeletons of city towers. The rubble wave was textured like a net. Rusting steel rods twisted gracefully as fine string, vast slabs of concrete still clinging there. The foreground might once have been a city square. There was a sort of stump, something that suggested a fountain. At its base, the children and the soldier were frozen. The tableau was confusing at first. Molly must have read it correctly before Case had quite assimilated it, because he felt her tense. She spat, then stood. Children. Feral, in rags. Teeth glittering like knives. Sores on their contorted faces. The soldier on his back. Mouth and throat open to the sky. They were feeding.
Bon,
she said, something like gentleness in her voice.
Quite the product, aren't you, Peter? But you had to be. Our three Jane, she's too jaded now to open the back door for just any petty thief. So Wintermute dug you up. The ultimate taste, if your taste runs that way. Demon lover. Peter.
She shivered.
But you talked her into letting me in. Thanks. Now we're gonna party.
And then she was walking, strolling really, in spite of the pain, away from Riviera's childhood. She drew the Fletcher from its holster, snapped the plastic magazine out, pocketed that, and replaced it with another. She hooked her thumb in the neck of the modern suit and ripped it open to the crotch with a single gesture, her thumb blade parting the tough polycarbon like rotten silk. She freed herself from the arms and legs, the shredded remnants disguising themselves as they fell to the dark, false sand. Case noticed the music then, a music he didn't know, all horns and piano. The entrance to Three Jane's world had no door. It was a ragged 5-meter gash in the tunnel wall, uneven stairs leading down in a broad, shallow curve. Faint blue light, moving shadows, music.
Case?
She said, and paused, the Fletcher in her right hand. Then she raised her left, smiled, touched her open palm with a wet tongue tip, kissing him through the SimStim link.
Gotta go.
Then there was something small and heavy in her left hand, her thumb against a tiny stud, and she was descending. Chapter 18. She missed it by a fraction. She nearly cut it, but not quite. She went in just right, Case thought, the right attitude. It was something he could sense, something he could have seen in the posture of another cowboy leaning into a deck, fingers flying across the board. She had it, the thing, the moves, and she'd pulled it all together for her entrance, pulled it together around the pain in her leg, and marched down Three Jane's stairs like she owned the place, elbow of her gun arm at her hip, forearm up, wrist relaxed, swaying the muzzle of the Fletcher with the studied nonchalance of a Regency duelist. It was a performance. It was like the culmination of a lifetime's observation of martial arts tapes, cheap ones, the kind Case had grown up on. For a few seconds, he knew, she was every badass hero. Sonny Mao in the old Shaw videos, Mickey Chiba, the whole lineage back to Lee and Eastwood. She was walking it the way she talked it. Lady Three Jane Marie-France Tessier Ashpool
had carved herself a low country flush with the inner surface of Straylight's hall, chopping away the maze of walls that was her legacy. She lived in a single room so broad and deep that its far reaches were lost to an inverse horizon, the floor hidden by the curvature of the spindle. The ceiling was low and irregular, done in the same imitation stone that walled the corridor. Here and there across the floor were jagged sections of wall, waist-high reminders of a labyrinth. There was a rectangular turquoise pool centered 10 meters from the foot of the stairway, its underwater floods the apartment's only source of light, or it seemed that way, to Case, as Molly took her final step. The pool threw shifting blobs of light across the ceiling above it. They were waiting by the pool. He'd known that her reflexes were souped up, jazzed by the neurosurgeons for combat, but he hadn't experienced them on the SimStim link. The effect was like tape run at half speed, a slow, deliberate dance choreographed to the killer instinct and years of training. She seemed to take the three of the men at a glance, the boy poised on the pool's high board, the girl grinning over her wine glass, and the corpse of Ashpool, his left socket gaping black and corrupt above his welcoming smile. He wore his maroon robe. His teeth were very white. The boy dove, slender, brown, his form perfect. The grenade left her hand before his hands could cut the water. Case knew the thing for what it was, as it broke the surface, a core of high explosive wrapped with 10 meters of fine, brittle steel wire. Her Fletcher whined as she sent a storm of explosive darts into Ashpool's face and chest, and he was gone, smoke curling from the pocked back of the empty, white-enameled pool chair. The muzzle swung for 3 Jane as the grenade detonated, a symmetrical wedding cake of water rising, breaking, falling back, but the mistake had been made. Hideo didn't even touch her then. Her leg collapsed. In Garvey, Case screamed. "It took you long enough," Riviera said, as he searched her pockets. Her hands vanished at the wrists in a matte black sphere the size of a bowling ball. "I saw a multiple assassination in Ankara," he said, his fingers plucking things from her jacket. "A grenade job, in a pool. It seemed a very weak explosion, but they all died instantly of hydrostatic shock." Case felt her move her fingers experimentally. The material of the ball seemed to offer no more resistance than temper foam. The pain in her leg was excruciating, impossible. A red moire shifted in her vision. "I wouldn't move them if I were you." The interior of the ball seemed to tighten slightly. "It's a sex toy Jane bought in Berlin. Wiggle them long enough and it crushes them to a pulp. Variant of the material they make this flooring from. Something to do with the molecules, I suppose." "Are you in pain?" She groaned. "You seem to have injured your leg." His fingers found the flat packet of drugs in the left back pocket of her jeans. "Well, my last taste from Ali. And just in time." The shifting mesh of blood began to whirl. "Hideo," said another voice, a woman's. "She's losing consciousness. Give her something, for that and for the pain. She's very striking, don't you think, Peter? These glasses, are they a fashion where she comes from?" Cool hands, unhurried, with a surgeon's certainty, the sting of a needle. "I wouldn't know," Ribeiro was saying. "I've never seen her native habitat. They came and took me from Turkey." "The sprawl, yes. We have interests there. And once we sent Hideo. My fault, really. I'd let someone in, a burglar. He took the family terminal." She laughed. "I made it easy for him, to annoy the others. He was a pretty boy, my burglar. Is she waking, Hideo? Shouldn't she have more?"
"More and she would die," said a third voice. The blood mesh slid into black. The music returned, horns and piano. Dance music. Case. Jack. Out. After images of the flashed words danced across Malcolm's eyes and creased forehead as Case removed the trodes.
You screamed, mon, while ago.
Molly,
he said, his throat dry.
Got hurt.
He took a white plastic squeeze bottle from the edge of the G-web and sucked out a mouthful of flat water.
I don't like how any of this shit is going.
The little cray monitor lit. The fin, against a background of twisted, impacted junk.
Neither do I. We got a problem.
Malcolm pulled himself up, over Case's head, twisted and peered over his shoulder.
Now who is that, mon Case?
That's just a picture, Malcolm, Case said wearily. Guy I know in the sprawl. It's Wintermute talking. Pictures supposed to make us feel at home.
Bullshit, the Finn said. Like I told Molly, these aren't masks. I need 'em to talk to you, 'cause I don't have what you think of as a personality, much. But all that's just pissing in the wind, Case, 'cause like I just said, we got a problem.
So express thyself, mute, Malcolm said.
Molly's leg's fallen off, for starts. Can't walk. How it was supposed to go down, she'd walk in, get Peter out of the way, talk the magic word out of 3 Jane, get up to the head and say it. Now she's blown it. So I want you two to go in after her.
Case stared at the face on the screen.
Us?
So who else?
Errol,
Case said. The guy on Babylon Rocker. Malcolm's pal.
No, gotta be you. Gotta be somebody who understands Molly, who understands Riviera. Malcolm for muscle.
You maybe forget that I'm in the middle of a little run here, remember? What you hauled my ass out here for?
Case, listen up. Time's tight. Very tight. Listen. The real link between your deck and Straylight is a sideband broadcast over Garby's navigation system. You'll take Garby into a very private dock, I'll show you. The Chinese virus has completely penetrated the fabric of the Hosaka. There's nothing in the Hosaka but virus now. When you dock, the virus will be interfaced with the Straylight custodial system and will cut the sideband. You'll take your deck, the flatline, and Malcolm. You'll find 3 Jane, get the word out of her, kill Riviera, get the key from Molly. You can keep track of the program by jacking your deck into the Straylight system. I'll handle it for you. There's a standard jack in the back of the head, behind a panel with 5 zircons.
Kill Riviera?
Kill him.
Case blinked at the representation of the fin. He felt Malcolm put his hand on his shoulder.
Hey, you forgot something.
He felt the rage rising and a kind of glee.
You fucked up. You blew the controls on the grapples when you blew Armitage. Hani was got us good and tight. Armitage fried the other Hosaka and the mainframes went with the bridge, right?
The Finn nodded.
So we're stuck out here, and that means you're fucked, man.
He wanted to laugh, but it caught in his throat.
Case, mon, Malcolm said softly. Garvey, a tug.
That's right,
said the Finn, and smiled.
You having fun in the big world outside?
The construct asked when Case jacked back in.
Figured that was Wintermute requesting the pleasure.
Yeah, you bet. Quang okay?
Bang on. Killer virus.
Okay, got some snags, but we're working on it.
You want to tell me, maybe?
Don't have time.
Well, boy, never mind me. I'm just dead anyway.
Fuck off,
Case said, and flipped, cutting off the torn fingernail edge of the flatline's laughter.
She dreamed of a state involving very little in the way of individual consciousness,
3 Jane was saying. She cupped a large cameo in her hand, extending it toward Molly. The carved profile was very much like her own.
Animal bliss, I think she viewed the evolution of the forebrain as a sort of sidestep.
She withdrew the brooch and studied it, tilting it to catch the light at different angles.
Only in certain heightened modes would an individual, a clan member, suffer the more painful aspects of self-awareness.
Molly nodded. Case remembered the injection. What had they given her? The pain was still there, but it came through as a tight focus of scrambled impressions. Neon worms writhing in her thigh, the touch of burlap, smell of frying krill. His mind recoiled from it. If he avoided focusing on it, the impressions overlapped, became a sensory equivalent of white noise. If it could do that to her nervous system, what would her frame of mind be? Her vision was abnormally clear and bright, even sharper than usual. Things seemed to vibrate, each person or object tuned to a minutely different frequency. Her hands, still locked in the black ball, were on her lap. She sat in one of the pool chairs, her broken leg propped straight in front of her on a camelskin hassock. 3Jane sat opposite, on another hassock, huddled in an oversized jalaba of unbleached wool. She was very young.
"Where'd he go?"
Molly asked.
"To take his shot?"
3Jane shrugged beneath the folds of the pale, heavy robe and tossed a strand of dark hair away from her eyes.
"He told me when to let you in," she said. "He wouldn't tell me why. Everything has to be a mystery. Would you have heard us?"
Case felt Molly hesitate.
"I would have killed him. I'd have tried to kill the ninja. Then I was supposed to talk with you."
"Why?" 3Jane asked, tucking the cameo back into one of the jalaba's inner pockets.
"And why? And what about?"
Molly seemed to be studying the high, delicate bones, the wide mouth, the narrow hawk nose. 3Jane's eyes were dark, curiously opaque.
"Because I hate him," she said at last. "And the why of that's just the way I'm wired. What he is, and what I am."
"And the show," 3Jane said. "I saw the show." Molly nodded.
"But Hideo?" "Because they're the best. Because one of them killed a partner of mine once."
3Jane became very grave. She raised her eyebrows.
"Because I had to see,"
Molly said.
"And then we would have talked, you and I, like this?"
Her dark hair was very straight, center-parted, drawn back into a knot of dull sterling.
"Shall we talk now?" "Take this off,"
Molly said, raising her captive hands.
"You killed my father,"
3Jane said, no change whatever in her tone.
"I was watching on the monitors. My mother's eyes, he called them." "He killed the puppet. It looked like you." "He was fond of broad gestures," she said,
and then Ribeiro was beside her, radiant with drugs, in the seersucker convict outfit he'd worn in the roof garden of their hotel. "Getting acquainted? She's an interesting girl, isn't she? I thought so when I first saw her." He stepped past 3Jane. "It isn't going to work, you know."
"Isn't it, Peter?"
Molly managed a grin. "Wintermute won't be the first to have made the same mistake, underestimating me." He crossed the tiled pool border to a white enamel table and splashed mineral water into a heavy crystal highball glass. "He talked with me, Molly. I suppose he talked to all of us, you and Case, whatever there is of Armitage to talk to. He can't really understand us, you know. He has his profiles, but those are only statistics. You may be the statistical animal, darling, and Case is nothing but I possess a quality unquantifiable by its very nature." He drank.
"And what exactly is that, Peter?"
Molly asked, her voice flat. Riviera beamed. "Perversity." He walked back to the two women, swirling the water that remained in the dense, deeply carved cylinder of rock crystal, as though he enjoyed the weight of the thing.
An enjoyment of the gratuitous act. And I have made a decision, Molly. A wholly gratuitous decision.
She waited, looking up at him.
Oh, Peter,
3 Jane said, with the sort of gentle exasperation ordinarily reserved for children.
No word for you, Molly. He told me about that, you see. 3 Jane knows the code, of course, but you won't have it. Neither will Wintermute. My Jane's an ambitious girl, in her perverse way.
He smiled again.
She has designs on the family empire, and a pair of insane artificial intelligences, kinky as the concept may be, would only get in our way. So, comes her Riviera to help her out, you see. And Peter says, sit tight. Play Daddy's favorite swing records and let Peter call you up a band to match, a floor of dancers, a wake for dead King Ashpool.
He drank off the last of the mineral water.
No, you wouldn't do, Daddy. You would not do,
now that Peter's come home. And then, his face pink with the pleasure of cocaine and meperidine, he swung the glass hard into her left lens implant, smashing vision into blood and light.
Malcolm was prone against the cabin ceiling when Case removed the trodes. A nylon sling around his waist was fastened to the panels on either side with shock cords and gray rubber suction pads. He had his shirt off and was working on a central panel with a clumsy-looking zero-G wrench, the thing's fat counter-springs twanging as he removed another hex head. Marcus Garvey was groaning and ticking with G-stress.
The mute take an eye and I doc, the Zionite said, popping the hex head into a mesh pouch at his waist. Malcolm pilot the landin'. Meantime, need we tool for the job?
You keep tools back there?
Case craned his neck and watched cords of muscle bunching in the brown back.
This one, Malcolm said, sliding a long bundle wrapped in black poly from the space behind the panel.
He replaced the panel, along with a single hex head, to hold it in place. The black package had drifted aft before he'd finished. He thumbed open the vacuum valves on the work belt's gray pads and freed himself, retrieving the thing he'd removed. He kicked back, gliding over his instruments, a green docking diagram pulsed on his central screen, and snagged the frame of Case's G-web. He pulled himself down and picked at the tape of his package with a thick, chipped thumbnail.
Some man in China say the truth comes out this, he said,
unwrapping an ancient, oil-slick Remington automatic shotgun, its barrel chopped off a few millimeters in front of the battered forestock. The shoulder stock had been removed entirely, replaced with a wooden pistol grip wound with dull black tape. He smelled of sweat and ganja.
That the only one you got?
Sure, mon, he said,
wiping oil from the black barrel with a red cloth, the black poly wrapping bunched around the pistol grip in his other hand.
I the Rastafarian Navy, believe it.
Case pulled the trodes down across his forehead. He'd never bothered to put the Texas catheter back on. At least he could take a real piss in the Bella Straylight, even if it was his last. He jacked in.
Hey, the construct said. Old Peter's totally apeshit, huh?
They seemed to be part of the Tessier Ashpool ice now. The emerald arches had widened, grown together, become a solid mass. Green predominated in the planes of the Chinese program that surrounded them.
Getting close, Dixie?
Real close. Need you soon.
Listen, Dix. Wintermute says Quang's set itself up solid in our Hosaka. I'm going to have to jack you and my deck out of the circuit, haul you into Straylight, and plug you back in, into the custodial program there, Wintermute says. Says the Quang virus will be all through there. Then we run from inside, through the Straylight net.
Wonderful, the flatline said. I never did like to do anything simple when I could do it ass backwards.
Case blipped. Into her darkness, a churning synesthesia, where her pain was the taste of old iron, scent of melon, wings of a moth brushing her cheek. She was unconscious, and he was barred from her dreams. When the optic chip flared, the alphanumerics were haloed, each one ringed with a faint pink aura. 072940.
I'm very unhappy with this, Peter.
Three Jane's voice seemed to arrive from a hollow distance. Molly could hear, he realized, then corrected himself. The SimStim unit was intact and still in place. He could feel it digging against her ribs. Her ears registered the vibrations of the girl's voice. Riviera said something brief and indistinct.
But I don't, she said, and it isn't fun. Hideo will bring a medical unit down from intensive care, but this needs a surgeon.
There was a silence. Very distinctly, Case heard the water lap against the side of the pool. What was that you were telling her when I came back? Riviera was very close now.
About my mother. She asked me to. I think she was in shock, aside from Hideo's injection. Why did you do that to her?
I wanted to see if they would break.
One did. When she comes around, if she comes around, we'll see what color her eyes are.
She's extremely dangerous. Too dangerous. If I hadn't been here to distract her, to throw up Ashpool to distract her, and my own Hideo to draw her little bomb, where would you be? In her power?
No, 3Jane said. There was Hideo. I don't think you quite understand about Hideo.
She does, evidently. Like a drink?
Wine, the white.
Case jacked out. Malcolm was hunched over Garvey's controls, tapping out commands for a docking sequence. The module's central screen displayed a fixed red square that represented the Straylight dock. Garvey was a larger square, green, that shrank slowly, wavering from side to side with Malcolm's commands. To the left, a smaller screen displayed a skeletal graphic of Garvey and Haniwa as they approached the curvature of the spindle.
We got an hour, man,
Case said, pulling the ribbon of fiber optics from the Hosaka. His deck's backup batteries were good for 90 minutes, but the Flatline's construct would be an additional drain. He worked quickly, mechanically, fastening the construct to the bottom of the Ono Sendai with micropore tape. Malcolm's work belt drifted past. He snagged it, unclipped the two lengths of shock cord with their gray rectangular suction pads, and hooked the jaws of one clip through the other. He held the pads against the sides of his deck and worked the thumb lever that created suction. With the deck, construct, and improvised shoulder strap suspended in front of him, he struggled into his leather jacket, checking the contents of his pockets. The passport Armitage had given him, the bank chip in the same name, the credit chip he'd been issued when he'd entered Freeside, 2 derms of the betaphenethylamine he'd bought from Bruce, a roll of New Yen, half a pack of Yehewans, and the shuriken. He tossed the Freeside chip over his shoulders, heard it click off the Russian scrubber. He was about to do the same with the steel star, but the rebounding credit chip clipped the back of his skull, spun off, struck the ceiling, and tumbled past Malcolm's left shoulder. The Zionite interrupted his piloting to glare back at him. Case looked at the shuriken, then tucked it into his jacket pocket, hearing the lining tear.
You missin' the mute, man, Malcolm said. Mute say he messin' the security for Garvey. Garvey dockin' his another boat. Boat they spectin' out of Babylon. Mute broadcastin' codes for us.
We gonna wear the suits?
Too heavy, Malcolm shrugged. Stay in web till I tell you.
He tapped a final sequence into the module and grabbed the worn pink handholds on either side of the navigation board. Case saw the green square shrink a final few millimeters to overlap the red square. On the smaller screen, Haniwa lowered her bow to miss the curve of the spindle and was snared. Garvey was still slung beneath her like a captive grub. The tug rang, shuddered. 2 stylized arms sprang out to grip the slender wasp shape.
stray light extruded a tentative yellow rectangle that curved, groping past Taniwa for Garbi. There was a scraping sound from the bow, beyond the trembling fronds of caulk.
"Mon," Malcolm said, "mind we got gravity."
A dozen small objects struck the floor of the cabin simultaneously, as though drawn there by a magnet. Case gasped as his internal organs were pulled into a different configuration. The deck and construct had fallen painfully to his lap. They were attached to the spindle now, rotating with it. Malcolm spread his arms, flexed tension from his shoulders, and removed his purple dread bag, shaking out his locks.
"Come now, Mon, if you said time be most precious."
Chapter 19. The Villa Straylight was a parasitic structure, Case reminded himself, as he stepped past the tendrils of caulk and through Marcus Garvey's forward hatch. Straylight bled air and water out of Freeside and had no ecosystem of its own. The gangway tube the dock had extended was a more elaborate version of the one he'd tumbled through to reach Haniwa, designed for use in the spindle's rotation gravity. A corrugated tunnel, articulated by integral hydraulic members, each segment ringed with a loop of tough, non-slip plastic, the loops serving as the rungs of a ladder. The gangway had snaked its way around Haniwa. It was horizontal, where it joined Garvey's lock, but curved up sharply and to the left, a vertical climb around the curvature of the yacht's hull. Malcolm was already making his way up the rings, pulling himself up with his left hand, the Remington in his right. He wore a stained pair of baggy fatigues, his sleeveless green nylon jacket, and a pair of ragged canvas sneakers with bright red soles. The gangway shifted slightly each time he climbed to another ring. The clips on Case's makeshift strap dug into his shoulder with the weight of the Ono Sendai and the Flatline's construct. All he felt now was fear, a generalized dread. He pushed it away, forcing himself to replay Armitage's lecture on the spindle and Villa Straylight. He started climbing. Freeside's ecosystem was limited, not closed. Zion was a closed system, capable of cycling for years without the introduction of external materials. Freeside produced its own air and water, but relied on constant shipments of food, on the regular augmentation of soil nutrients. The Villa Straylight produced nothing at all.
"Mon," Malcolm said quietly, "get up here side me."
Case edged sideways on the circular ladder and climbed the last few rungs. The gangway ended in a smooth, slightly convex hatch, 2 meters in diameter. The hydraulic members of the tube vanished into flexible housings set into the frame of the hatch.
"So, what do we—"
Case's mouth shut as the hatch swung up, a slight differential in pressure puffing fine grit into his eyes. Malcolm scrambled up over the edge, and Case heard the tiny click of the Remington safety being released.
"You the Mon in the hurry,"
Malcolm whispered, crouching there. Then Case was beside him. The hatch was centered in a round, vaulted chamber floored with blue non-slip plastic tiles. Malcolm nudged him, pointed, and he saw a monitor set into a curved wall. On the screen, a tall young man with the Tessier Ashpool features was brushing something from the sleeves of his dark suit coat. He stood beside an identical hatch, in an identical chamber.
"Very sorry, sir," said a voice from a grid centered above the hatch.
Case glanced up.
"Expected you later, at the axial dock. One moment, please."
On the monitor, the young man tossed his head impatiently. Malcolm spun as a door slid open to their left, the shotgun ready. A small Eurasian in orange coveralls stepped through and goggled at them. He opened his mouth, but nothing came out. He closed his mouth. Case glanced at the monitor. Blank.
"Who?"
the man managed.
"The Rastafarian Navy,"
Case said, standing up, the cyberspace deck banging against his hip.
and all we want's a jack into your custodial system.
The man swallowed.
Is this a test? It's a loyalty check. It must be a loyalty check.
He wiped the palms of his hands on the thighs of his orange suit.
No, mon. This a real one.
Malcolm came up out of his crouch with the Remington pointed at the Eurasian's face.
You move it.
They followed the man back through the door, into a corridor whose polished concrete walls and irregular floor of overlapping carpets were perfectly familiar to Case.
Pretty rugs, Malcolm said, prodding the man in the back. Smell like church.
They came to another monitor, an antique Sony, this one mounted above a console with a keyboard and a complex array of jack panels. The screen lit as they halted, the Finn grinning tensely out at them from what seemed to be the front room of Metro Holographics.
Okay, he said. Malcolm takes this guy down the corridor to the open locker door, sticks him in there. I'll lock it. Case, you want the fifth socket from the left, top panel. There's adapter plugs in the cabinet under the console. Needs Ono Sendai 20 point into Itachi 40.
As Malcolm nudged his captive along, Case knelt and fumbled through an assortment of plugs, finally coming up with the one he needed. With his deck jacked into the adapter, he paused.
Do you have to look like that, man?
He asked the face on the screen. The fin was erased a line at a time by the image of Lonnie Zone against a wall of peeling Japanese posters.
Anything you want, baby, Zone drawled. Just hop it for Lonnie.
No, Case said. Use the fin.
As the Zone image vanished, he shoved the Hitachi adapter into its socket and settled the trodes across his forehead.
What kept you?
The flatline asked and laughed.
Told you don't do that, Case said.
Joke, boy, the construct said. Zero time-lapse for me. Let me see what we got here.
The Quang program was green, exactly the shade of the TA ice. Even as Case watched, it grew gradually more opaque, although he could see the black-mirrored shark thing clearly when he looked up. The fracture lines and hallucinations were gone now, and the thing looked real as Marcus Garvey, a wingless antique jet, its smooth skin plated with black chrome.
Right on,
the flatline said.
Right,
Case said, and flipped.
Like that. I'm sorry,
3Jane was saying as she bandaged Molly's head.
Our unit says no concussion, no permanent damage to the eye. You didn't know him very well before you came here?
Didn't know him at all,
Molly said bleakly. She was on her back in a high bed or padded table. Case couldn't feel the injured leg. The synesthetic effect of the original injection seemed to have worn off. The black ball was gone, but her hands were immobilized by soft straps she couldn't see.
He wants to kill you.
Figures,
Molly said, staring up at the rough ceiling past a very bright light.
I don't think I want him to,
3Jane said, and Molly painfully turned her head to look up into the dark eyes.
Don't play with me,
she said.
But I think I might like to,
3Jane said, and bent to kiss her forehead, brushing the hair back with a warm hand. There were smears of blood on her pale jalaba.
Where's he gone now?
Molly asked.
Another injection, probably,
3Jane said, straightening up.
He was quite impatient for your arrival. I think it might be fun to nurse you back to health, Molly.
She smiled, absently wiping a bloody hand down the front of the robe.
Your leg will need to be reset, but we can arrange that.
What about Peter?
Peter.
She gave her head a little shake. A strand of dark hair came loose, fell across her forehead.
Peter has become rather boring. I find drug use in general to be boring.
She giggled.
In others, at any rate. My father was a dedicated abuser, as you must have seen.
Molly tensed.
Don't alarm yourself.
Three Jane's fingers brushed the skin above the waistband of the leather jeans.
His suicide was the result of my having manipulated the safety margins of his freeze. I'd never actually met him, you know. I was decanted after he last went down to sleep. But I did know him very well. The Corps know everything. I watched him kill my mother. I'll show you that when you're better. He strangles her in bed. Why did he kill her?
Her unbandaged eye focused on the girl's face.
He couldn't accept the direction she intended for our family. She commissioned the construction of our artificial intelligences. She was quite a visionary. She imagined us in a symbiotic relationship with the AIs. Our corporate decisions made for us. Our conscious decisions, I should say. Tessier Ashpool would be immortal, a hive, each of us units of a larger entity. Fascinating. I'll play her tapes for you, nearly 1,000 hours, but I've never understood her really, and with her death, her direction was lost. All direction was lost, and we began to burrow into ourselves. Now we seldom come out. I'm the exception there.
You said you were trying to kill the old man? You fiddled with his cryogenic programs?
3Jane nodded.
I had help. From a ghost. That was what I thought when I was very young, that there were ghosts in the corporate cores. Voices. One of them was what you call Wintermute, which is the Turing code for our Burn AI, although the entity manipulating you is a sort of sub-program.
One of them? There's more?
One other. But that one hasn't spoken to me in years. It gave up, I think. I suspect that both represent the fruition of certain capacities my mother ordered designed into the original software, but she was an extremely secretive woman when she felt it necessary. Here, drink.
She put a flexible plastic tube to Molly's lips.
Water, only a little.
Jane, love, Riviera asked cheerfully from somewhere out of sight, are you enjoying yourself?
Leave us alone, Peter.
Playing doctor. Suddenly Molly stared into her own face, the image suspended 10 centimeters from her nose. There were no bandages. The left implant was shattered, a long finger of silvered plastic driven deep in a socket that was an inverted pool of blood.
Hideo,
3Jane said, stroking Molly's stomach.
Hurt Peter if he doesn't go away. Go and swim, Peter.
The projection vanished. 075840, in the darkness of the bandaged eye.
He said you know the code, Peter said. Wintermute needs the code.
Case was suddenly aware of the chub key that lay on its nylon thong against the inner curve of her left breast.
Yes,
3Jane said, withdrawing her hand.
I do. I learned it as a child. I think I learned it in a dream, or somewhere in the 1,000 hours of my mother's diaries. But I think that Peter has a point in urging me not to surrender it. There would be Turing to contend with, if I read all this correctly, and ghosts are nothing if not capricious.
Case jacked out.
Strange little customer, huh?
The Finn grinned at Case from the old Sony. Case shrugged. He saw Malcolm coming back along the corridor with the Remington at his side. The Zionite was smiling, his head bobbing to a rhythm Case couldn't hear. A pair of thin yellow leads ran from his ears to a side pocket in his sleeveless jacket.
Dub, man, Malcolm said.
You're fucking crazy,
Case told him.
Here okay, man. Righteous dub.
Hey, guys,
the Finn said.
On your toes. Here comes your transportation. I can't finesse many numbers as smooth as the pick of 8 Jean that conned your doorman, but I can get you a ride over to 3Jane's place.
Case was pulling the adapter from its socket when the riderless service cart swiveled into sight, under the graceless concrete arch marking the far end of their corridor. It might have been the one his Africans had ridden, but if it was, they were gone now. Just behind the back of a low padded seat, its tiny manipulators gripping the upholstery, the little brawn was steadily winking its red LED.
Bus to catch, Case said to Malcolm.
Chapter 20.
He lost his anger again. He missed it. The little cart was crowded. Malcolm, the Remington across his knees, and Case, deck and construct against his chest. The cart was operating at speeds it hadn't been designed for. It was top-heavy cornering, and Malcolm had taken to leaning out in the direction of the turns. This presented no problem when the thing took lefts, because Case sat on the right, but in the right turns, the Zionite had to lean across Case and his gear, crushing him against the seat. He had no idea where they were. Everything was familiar, but he couldn't be sure he'd seen any particular stretch before. A curving hallway lined with wooden showcases displayed collections he was certain he'd never seen. The skulls of large birds, coins, masks of beaten silver. The service cart's six tires were silent on the layered carpets. There was only the whine of the electric motor and an occasional faint burst of Zion dub from the foam beads in Malcolm's ears as he lunged past Case to counter a sharp right. The deck and the construct kept pressing the shuriken in his jacket pocket into his hip.
"You got a watch?"
he asked Malcolm. The Zionite shook his locks.
"Time be time." "Jesus," Case said, and closed his eyes.
The bronze scuttled over mounded carpets and tapped one of its padded claws against an oversized rectangular door of dark, battered wood. Behind them, the cart sizzled and shot blue sparks from a louvered panel. The sparks struck the carpet beneath the cart, and Case smelled scorched wool.
"This the way, mon?"
Malcolm eyed the door and snapped the shotgun's safety.
"Hey,"
Case said, more to himself than to Malcolm.
"You think I know?"
The brawn rotated its spherical body, and the LED strobed.
"It want you open door,"
Malcolm said, nodding. Case stepped forward and tried the ornate brass knob. There was a brass plate mounted on the door at eye level, so old that the lettering that had once been engraved there had been reduced to a spidery, unreadable code, the name of some long-dead function or functionary, polished into oblivion. He wondered vaguely if Tessier Ashpool had selected each piece of Straylight individually, or if they'd purchased it in bulk from some vast European equivalent of Metro Holographics. The door's hinges creaked plaintively as he edged it open, Malcolm stepping past him with the Remington thrust forward from his hip.
"Books,"
Malcolm said. "The library. The white steel shelves with their labels."
"I know where we are,"
Case said. He looked back at the service cart. A curl of smoke was rising from the carpet.
"So come on,"
he said.
"Cart."
"Cart?" It remained stationary. The brawn was plucking at the leg of his jeans, nipping at his ankle. He resisted a strong urge to kick it.
"Yeah?"
It ticked its way around the door. He followed it. The monitor in the library was another Sony, as old as the first one. The brawn paused beneath it and executed a sort of jig.
"Wintermute?"
The familiar features filled the screen. The Finn smiled.
"Time to check in, Case,"
the Finn said, his eyes screwed up against the smoke of a cigarette.
"Come on, Jack."
The brawn threw itself against his ankle and began to climb his leg, its manipulators pinching his flesh through the thin black cloth.
"Shit!"
He slapped it aside and it struck the wall. Two of its limbs began to piston repeatedly, uselessly, pumping the air.
"What's wrong with the goddamn thing?"
"Burned out," the Finn said. "Forget it, no problem. Jack in now." There were four sockets beneath the screen, but only one would accept the Hitachi adapter. He jacked in. Nothing. Gray void. No matrix, no grid. No cyberspace. The deck was gone. His fingers were and on the far rim of consciousness, a scurrying, a fleeting impression of something rushing toward him across leagues of black mirror. He tried to scream. There seemed to be a city beyond the curve of beach, but it was far away. He crouched on his haunches on the damp sand, his arms wrapped tight across his knees, and shook. He stayed that way for what seemed a very long time, even after the shaking stopped. The city, if it was a city, was low and gray. At times it was obscured by banks of mist that came rolling in over the lapping surf. At one point he decided that it wasn't a city at all, but some single building, perhaps a ruin. He had no way of judging its distance. The sand was the shade of tarnished silver that hadn't gone entirely black. The beach was made of sand. The beach was very long. The sand was damp. The bottoms of his jeans were wet from the sand. He held himself and rocked, singing a song without words or tune. The sky was a different silver. Chiba, like the Chiba sky. Tokyo Bay? He turned his head and stared out to sea, longing for the hologram logo of Fuji Electric, for the drone of a helicopter, anything at all. Behind him, a gull cried. He shivered. A wind was rising. Sand stung his cheek. He put his face against his knees and wept, the sound of his sobbing as distant and alien as the cry of the searching gull. Hot urine soaked his jeans, dribbled on the sand, and quickly cooled in the wind off the water. When his tears were gone, his throat ached.
Wintermute,
he mumbled to his knees.
Wintermute.
It was growing dark now, and when he shivered, it was with a cold that finally forced him to stand. His knees and elbows ached. His nose was running. He wiped it on the cuff of his jacket, then searched one empty pocket after another.
Jesus,
he said, shoulders hunched, tucking his fingers beneath his arms for warmth.
Jesus.
His teeth began to chatter. The tide had left the beach combed with patterns more subtle than any a Tokyo gardener produced. When he'd taken a dozen steps in the direction of the now invisible city, he turned and looked back through the gathering dark. His footprints stretched to the point of his arrival. There were no other marks to disturb the tarnished sand. He estimated that he'd covered at least a kilometer before he noticed the light. He was talking with Rats, and it was Rats who first pointed it out, an orange-red glow to his right, away from the surf. He knew that Rats wasn't there, that the bartender was a figment of his own imagination, not of the thing he was trapped in, but that didn't matter. He'd called the man up for comfort of some kind, but Rats had had his own ideas about Case and his predicament.
Really, my artiste, you amaze me. The lengths you will go to in order to accomplish your own destruction. The redundancy of it. In Night City, you had it, in the palm of your hand. The speed to eat your sense away, drink to keep it all so fluid, Linda for a sweeter sorrow, and the street to hold the axe. How far you've come to do it now, and what grotesque props. Playgrounds hung in space. Castles hermetically sealed, the rarest rots of old Europa, dead men sealed in little boxes, magic out of China.
Rats laughed, trudging along beside him, his pink manipulator swinging jauntily at his side. In spite of the dark, Case could see the baroque steel that laced the bartender's blackened teeth.
But I suppose that is the way of an artiste, no? You needed this world built for you, this beach, this place, to die.
Case halted, swayed, turned toward the sound of surf and the sting of blown sand.
Yeah, he said. Shit. I guess.
He walked toward the sound.
Artiste, he heard Rat's call. The light. You saw a light. Here. This way.
He stopped again, staggered, fell to his knees in a few millimeters of icy seawater.
Rats? Light? Rats?
But the dark was total now, and there was only the sound of the surf. He struggled to his feet and tried to retrace his steps. Time passed. He walked on. And then it was there, a glow, defining itself with his every step, a rectangle, a door.
Fire in there,
he said, his words torn away by the wind. It was a bunker, stone or concrete, buried in drifts of the dark sand. The doorway was low, narrow, doorless, and deep, set into a wall at least a meter thick.
Hey,
Case said, softly.
Hey.
His fingers brushed the cold wall. There was a fire in there, shifting shadows on the sides of the entrance. He ducked low and was through, inside, in three steps. A girl was crouched beside rusted steel, a sort of fireplace, where driftwood burned, the wind sucking smoke up a dented chimney. The fire was the only light, and as his gaze met the wide, startled eyes, he recognized her headband, a rolled scarf, printed with a pattern like magnified circuitry. He refused her arms that night, refused the food she offered him, the place beside her in the nest of blankets and shredded foam. He crouched beside the door, finally, and watched her sleep, listening to the wind scour the structure's walls. Every hour or so he rose and crossed to the makeshift stove, adding fresh driftwood from the pile beside it. None of this was real, but cold was cold. She wasn't real, curled there on her side in the firelight. He watched her mouth, the lips parted slightly. She was the girl he remembered from their trip across the bay. And that was cruel.
Mean motherfucker,
he whispered to the wind. Don't take a chance, do you? Wouldn't give me any junkie, huh? I know what this is. He tried to keep the desperation from his voice.
I know, see? I know who you are. You're the other one. Three Jane told Molly. Burning bush. That wasn't Wintermute, it was you. He tried to warn me off with the brawn. Now you got me flatlined. You got me here. Nowhere. With a ghost. Like I remember her before.
She stirred in her sleep, called something out, drawing a scrap of blanket across her shoulder and cheek.
You aren't anything,
he said to the sleeping girl. You're dead, and you meant fuck all to me anyway.
Hear that, buddy? I know what you're doing. I'm flatlined. This is all taking about 20 seconds, right? I'm out on my ass in that library, and my brain's dead, and pretty soon it'll be dead, if you got any sense. You don't want Wintermute to pull his scam off, is all, so you can just hang me up here. Dixie'll run Quang, but his ass is dead, and you can second-guess his moves, sure. This Linda shit. Yeah. That's all been you, hasn't it? Wintermute tried to use her when he sucked me into the Chiba construct, but he couldn't, said it was too tricky. That was you moved the stars around in Freeside, wasn't it? That was you put her face on the dead puppet in Ashpool's room. Molly never saw that. You just edited her SimStim signal. Cause you think you can hurt me. Cause you think I gave a shit. Well, fuck you, whatever you're called. You won. You win. But none of it means anything to me now, right? Think I care? So why'd you do it to me this way?
He was shaking again, his voice shrill.
Honey?
She said, twisting up from the rags of blankets.
You come here and sleep. I'll sit up, you want. You gotta sleep, okay?
Her soft accent was exaggerated with sleep.
You just sleep, okay?
When he woke, she was gone. The fire was dead, but it was warm in the bunker, sunlight slanting through the doorway to throw a crooked rectangle of gold on the ripped side of a fat fiber canister. The thing was a shipping container. He remembered them from the Chiba docks. Through the rent in its side, he could see half a dozen bright yellow packets. In the sunlight, they looked like giant pats of butter. His stomach tightened with hunger. Rolling out of the nest, he went to the canister and fished one of the things out, blinking its small print in a dozen languages. The English was on the bottom. Emergency ration, high pro, beef, type AG8. A listing of nutritive content. He fumbled a second one out. Eggs.
If you're making this shit up, he said, you could lay on some real food, okay?
With a packet in either hand, he made his way through the structure's four rooms. Two were empty, aside from drifts of sand, and the fourth held three more of the ration canisters.
Sure, he said, touching the seals. Stay here a long time. I get the idea. Sure.
He searched the room with the fireplace, finding a plastic canister filled with what he assumed was rainwater. Beside the nest of blankets, against the wall, lay a cheap red lighter, a seaman's knife with a cracked green handle, and her scarf. It was still knotted, and stiff with sweat and dirt. He used the knife to open the yellow packets, dumping their contents into a rusted can that he found beside the stove. He dipped water from the canister, mixed the resulting mush with his fingers, and ate. It tasted vaguely like beef. When it was gone, he tossed the can into the fireplace and went out. Late afternoon, by the feel of the sun, its angle, he kicked off his damp nylon shoes and was startled by the warmth of the sand. In daylight, the beach was silver gray. The sky was cloudless, blue. He rounded the corner of the bunker and walked toward the surf, dropping his jacket on the sand.
Don't know whose memories you're using for this one,
he said when he reached the water. He peeled off his jeans and kicked them into the shallow surf, following them with t-shirt and underwear.
What you doing, Case?
He turned and found her 10 meters down the beach, the white foam sliding past her ankles.
I pissed myself last night, he said.
Well, you don't want to wear those. Salt water. Give you sores. I'll show you this pool back in the rocks.
She gestured vaguely behind her.
It's fresh.
The faded French fatigues had been hacked away above the knee. The skin below was smooth and brown. A breeze caught at her hair.
Listen, he said, scooping his clothes up and walking toward her. I got a question for you. I won't ask you what you're doing here, but what exactly do you think I'm doing here?
He stopped, a wet black jeans leg slapping against his bare thigh.
You came last night, she said.
She smiled at him.
And that's enough for you? I just came?
He said you would,
she said, wrinkling her nose. She shrugged.
He knows stuff like that, I guess.
She lifted her left foot and rubbed salt from the other ankle. Awkward. childlike. She smiled at him again, more tentatively.
Now you answer me one, okay?
He nodded.
How come you're painted brown like that? All except your foot.